Well, I think there's a number of things. Obviously people need to share their concerns with their representatives and to talk about that we shouldn't be cutting key programs that families rely on to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy. So, right now the Republicans are trying to pass this big tax bill and, they're meeting at one of Trump's fancy resorts in Florida to talk about what they're going to do. So this thing is coming. We know it's coming, and we really need to talk about that they're going to spend $4 trillion for tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the rich. And that is just crazy. That is really crazy.
Yeah. And are there policies? I mean, it seems like folks are saying, why can't we bring back the world before Citizens United? But maybe we just need a whole new vision. Is there anything in the works legislatively or policy-wise apart from vigilance and reporting that we can look to support?
Well, there are really great things that we can do to make sure that your average family is treated fairly. So, I mean, the first thing is to let these Trump tax cuts expire for people who are wealthy, right? I mean, just let the stuff go. They passed from 2017, and for the wealthy, they shouldn't get any more tax cuts. And then there's lots of other things that we can do. The President Biden and also the top Democrat on the Finance Committee, Ron Wyden, had these proposals to make sure that we were taxing billionaires so that their wealth, just like when you pay every 2 weeks, you pay taxes on your paycheck, that they would have to pay taxes on their wealth. And I think that would be a very important change to make sure that we had a much more fair tax system. And I think the other part of this is we've talked about, but it is just so undemocratic to have this extreme wealth gap where billionaires can use this wealth to be able to, make a much louder voice than your average American. So those are some of the things. I think, there are things we can do. We've got to stop this bill from passing. People thought when Trump came into office in 2017 that the ACA, the Obamacare was going to be gone, that Republicans would get rid of it. And they didn't. They weren't able to. They tried. But because there was so much backlash, because so many people protested, they lost. And this is an uphill battle, but, we really have to work and organize and fight to show that more tax cuts for the wealthy coming out of the pockets of families is the wrong approach.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with David Kass from Americans for Tax Fairness. Their work is online at americansfortaxfairness.org. Thank you so much, David Kass, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among many other things, 2024 was a series of reminders that corporate news media, tasked primarily with enriching the rich and shoring up entrenched institutions, will not, today or ever, do the liberatory, illuminating work of independent reporting that boldly speaks truth to power, that stands up for the societally voiceless, that provides space for the debates and discussions we need to move society forward. for those of us that believe that U.S. society needs to change. New calendar years are symbolic, sure, but they can also offer a metaphorical fresh start. Why not see 2025 as a much-needed opportunity to acknowledge, support, create, and grow independent journalism? We'll talk about that today with two people who are and have been doing, not just critical dissident.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
China's running the Panama Canal. That was not given to China, that was given to Panama foolishly. But they violated the agreement, and we're going to take it back, or something very powerful is going to happen.
President Trump has reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal after Marco Rubio visited Panama on his first foreign trip as Secretary of State. We'll go to Panama and to Guatemala, where Rubio will be today. On Monday, Rubio met with El Salvador's authoritarian leader, who's offering to jail U.S. citizens for a fee and accept deportees from any country. We'll also look at Trump's plan to house as many as 30,000 immigrants at Guantanamo, the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. Then to Trump's threats to deport pro-Palestinian student protesters. In a recent executive order, Trump urged schools to, quote, monitor and report activities by alien students, unquote. We'll speak to a Cornell University graduate student who faced deportation last year after taking part in Gaza's solidarity protests.
My university, Cornell, was presented with a crossroads, and they failed with their attempts to see me deported. Now they have been presented with another crossroad. Will they stand by their students? As we have seen the executive orders rolling in, targeting pro-Palestinian protesters, or will they fail again? We're still waiting to see.
We'll also speak to an Israeli reporter from Haaretz. His new article, "We Will Find You and We Will Deport You: Why Trump's Executive Order on Anti-Semitism is So Dangerous." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. China's announced retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods after President Trump initiated a trade war by imposing an additional 10% tariff on all Chinese products. China's finance ministry said it would levy 15% tariffs on U.S. coal and liquefied natural gas, and 10% on crude oil, farm equipment, and some U.S.-made vehicles. China's also imposing new export controls on certain minerals, including rare earth elements critical to the electronics industry. This comes after Trump said he would delay plans by at least a month to impose tariffs of 25% on Canada and Mexico. Trump's reversal came after the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised to take steps to crack down on fentanyl smuggling at the U.S. border, even though Canada contributes less than 1% of fentanyl consumed illegally in the U.S. And Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said Trump called off the tariffs after she agreed to send 10,000 troops to the border.
He asked me how long I wanted to pause tariffs. I said forever. He told me, how much time? I told him a month. I'm sure that during this month we'll be able to deliver good results for his people and the people of Mexico.
President Sheinbaum said that under the deal, the U.S. pledged to slow the illegal trafficking of weapons to Mexico, though Trump's account of the agreement on Truth Social made no mention of that commitment. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's named Trump ally and State Department official Pete Maracco as acting administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, that's USAID, after the Trump administration placed staff members on leave and took the agency's website and social media accounts offline. NBC reports under the first Trump administration, Maracco's efforts to consolidate power and slash funding drove officials to write a dissent memo that ultimately pushed him out of office. Maracco was also reportedly among the insurrectionists who attacked the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021. On Monday, a group of House and Senate Democrats rallied outside USAID's shuttered headquarters in Washington, D.C., and were denied entry to the building. This is Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota.
This is what the beginning of dictatorship looks like. When you gut the Constitution and you install yourself as the sole power, that is how dictators are made. What Trump and Elon and all of their cronies are trying to do is take away the constitutional power of Congress.
A federal court in Washington, D.C. has extended a temporary injunction against President Trump's effort to freeze trillions of dollars of federal spending. U.S. District Judge Lauren Alikhan ruled Trump's order appears to violate the Constitution's separation of powers, which grants Congress the authority to tax and spend. She also cited the catastrophic impact the freeze would have on millions of people who receive government services, including food, home heating, and medical assistance. On Monday, protesters gathered outside the Office of Personnel Management, which associates of Elon Musk have taken over. The White House has confirmed Musk is now a special government employee with a government email address and office space in the White House complex. Musk tweeted Monday he had deleted a government agency that worked on a free online system for filing 2024 tax returns directly with the IRS, although for now the software appears to remain available. Companies including H&R Block and TurboTax are seeking to protect their multi-billion dollar industry, which sees the average U.S. taxpayer spend $140 a year on tax preparation software. This comes after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said he had halted most of the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the agency established after the 2008 banking crisis to prevent unfair, deceptive, or predatory financial practices. The Trump administration's deactivated the Famine Early Warning System network after the State Department issued a stop work order on all U.S. foreign assistance, with exceptions for some emergency food aid and military aid for Egypt and Israel. The monitoring program was established after the 1984 famine in Ethiopia. More recently, it predicted the unfolding hunger crisis in Sudan, where fighting between rival military factions has plunged half the population, some 25 million people, into high levels of acute food insecurity. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwandan-backed M23 forces have declared a ceasefire, pausing all fighting in the east of the country for humanitarian reasons. The deal, which begins today, comes after at least 900 people were killed as M23 fighters seized the eastern city of Goma over the past week. International groups have called on sanctions and an arms embargo against Rwanda over its support of M23. In an interview with CNN, the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, claimed he was unaware of any Rwanda and military troops fighting in the eastern DRC.
Today, on the 3rd of February, does Rwanda currently have any troops at all in eastern DRC?
I don't know.
You're the commander-in-chief?
Yeah. There are many things I don't know.
Meanwhile, the World Food Program says 25.6 million people across the DRC are facing acute food insecurity. 4.5 million children under the age of 5 require treatment for malnutrition. Israel's 15-month-long assault on Gaza has killed more than 61,700 Palestinians, according to the Gaza Government Media Office, which added over 14,000 people missing and presumed dead to its death toll. Nearly 18,000 of that total are children, including 214 newborn infants. A recent study in The Lancet finds the true death toll in Gaza may be 40% higher than official figures. Over 2 million people have been displaced. Gaza officials warn this week the most urgent humanitarian need is for temporary shelters, as thousands of Palestinian families are sleeping outdoors in frigid temperatures. Authorities say Israel's continuing to obstruct aid access to Gaza, violating the terms of the ceasefire. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting with Trump at the White House today. Ahead of their meeting, Trump said there were no guarantees the Gaza ceasefire will hold. Trump also recently called for the, quote, cleaning out of Gaza and forcibly expelling its population to neighboring countries. This comes amidst reports Netanyahu will not commit to implementing the second stage of the ceasefire and is refusing to withdraw troops from Gaza while Hamas remains in political power. In the occupied West Bank, the Oscar-nominated director, Bassel Adra, filmed armed and masked Israeli settlers attacking his community of Masafer Yatta last night. The settlers threw stones, smashed vehicles, slashed tires, and punctured a water tank. Israeli soldiers on the scene did not intervene to halt the crimes. Bassel Adra's film, No Other Land, is about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians living in Masafer Yatta. It's been nominated for an Academy Award. The Palestinian Ministry of Health says Israeli forces have killed at least 70 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the start of this year, more than half of those in Jenin. Al Jazeera's published satellite images that show Israel's building out 7 military bases within the demilitarized buffer zone with Syria following the ouster of Bashar al-Assad in December. One of the bases is being built outside the buffer zone, inside Syrian territory. Israel's incursions into Syria violate a 1974 truce that designated the area of the Golan Heights as a buffer zone. Here in New York, three Columbia University students filed a lawsuit Monday against Columbia's administration after they were suspended last year, just ahead of graduation, for taking part in peaceful campus protests for Palestinian rights. This is one of the plaintiffs, Catherine Curran Groom.
This all comes in response to Columbia's repression against us, where they created sham disciplinary proceedings to target and discriminate against us. And this led to the suspension and, in my case, effective expulsion from the university. Today, we stand here saying that not only do we refuse to be intimidated by the university, but we actively seek through this lawsuit to hold our university accountable for their violation of our rights and for the immeasurable harm that they have inflicted upon us and anti-Zionist students like us who are simply struggling for Palestinian rights to freedom and safety.
To see our coverage of the Gaza Solidarity protests at Columbia and campuses across the country, go to democracynow.org. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with a student who was almost deported at Cornell University, and we'll speak with an Israeli reporter from Haaretz. The Senate has confirmed fracking executive Chris Wright as Secretary of Energy. Wright has long advocated for fossil fuels and has publicly denied the existence of the climate crisis. He's the founder of the Denver-based oil field firm Liberty Energy, and until recently served on the board of Oklo, a nuclear power startup. His confirmation came as the Trump administration sent emails to over 1,100 Environmental Protection Agency recently hired workers, warning them they could be fired at any time. The New York Times reports the affected staffers work on climate change, air pollution reduction, clean energy, and enforcing environmental laws like lead pipe remediation. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Monday unveiled an agreement with the government of El Salvador, which says it will receive immigrants and asylum seekers from different countries who are deported from the United States. In his remarks Monday, Rubio praised Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, who's been accused of gross human rights abuses and of violating El Salvador's constitution by remaining in power for a third presidential term.
He has agreed to accept for deportation any illegal alien in the United States who is a criminal from any nationality, be they MS-13 or Tren de Aragua, and house them in his jails. And third, he has offered to house in his jails dangerous American criminals in custody in our country, including those of U.S. citizenship and legal residence.
Rubio's visit to El Salvador came after he met with officials in Panama. Rubio is heading to Costa Rica, then Guatemala today, before making a trip in the Dominican Republic as part of his first foreign trip as Trump's Secretary of State. We'll have more on the trip after headlines. Businesses across the U.S., from child daycares to grocery stores, closed their doors Monday to mark a day without immigrants in a protest of the Trump administration's mass raids and deportations. Students also skipped school to join the peaceful action. Thousands took part in the streets and cities nationwide, including Phoenix, Arizona, New York, and Los Angeles. Protesters also rallied outside Trump Tower in downtown Chicago. This is Melanie, the daughter of undocumented immigrants, who held a sign that read, "Speaking out for immigrants who can't."
On the other side, I have, like, Immigrants Built America, because who's the one who does your crops? It's immigrants. They're the ones in the fields. Who picks up your trash? It's immigrants. They're the ones that are cleaning out the offices, the bathrooms, everywhere you work. They're the ones that clean up. They're not the ones that are sitting in an office desk doing paperwork. They're the ones behind everything.
President Trump has named his former speech writer, Darren Beatty, to a senior position at the State Department. Beatty was fired in 2018 after CNN reported he'd spoken at a conference attended by white nationalists. Last October, Beatty wrote, quote, "Competent white men must be in charge if you want things to work," unquote. And in Germany, 160,000 demonstrators rallied at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate Sunday to condemn conservative leader Friedrich Merz for collaborating with the extreme right Alternative for Germany party to push an anti-immigrant measure. The bill ultimately failed after members of his own CDU party refused to support it. Merz has been favored to become Germany's next chancellor in the upcoming elections. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, President Trump has reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal. We'll go to Panama City and to Guatemala City, where Rubio will be today. Stay with us.
Now promises broken. Nemesis. Our token. You turn around, march on to your new home. Oh. Wherever you're gone, darling, please don't you ever forget to treat others the way you want to be treated.
Nemesis by Benjamin Clementine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is traveling to Costa Rica and Guatemala City today before heading to the Dominican Republic as part of his first foreign trip in his new post. Rubio was just in Panama and El Salvador. After meeting with Rubio on Monday, El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, announced in a statement his country would receive immigrants and asylum seekers of any nationality deported from the United States. He also offered to jail U.S. citizens who are convicted of crimes for a fee in El Salvador's troubled maximum security mega prison complex. Bukele said the fee would be, quote, low for the U.S., but significant for us, making our entire prison system sustainable, he said. Rubio spoke on Monday.
He has agreed to accept for deportation any illegal alien in the United States who is a criminal from any nationality, be they MS-13 or Tren de Aragua, and house them in his jails. And third, he has offered to house in his jails dangerous American criminals in custody in our country, including those of U.S. citizenship and legal residence.
Secretary of State Rubio praised Salvadoran President Bukele, who's been accused of gross human rights abuses and of violating Salvador's constitution by remaining in power for a third presidential term. Bukele has been enforcing a state of emergency for nearly 3 years, leading to the detention of over 83,000 people without access to due process. Human rights groups estimate hundreds of people have died in Bukele's prison since March 2022. This comes after far-right immigration hardliner, White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy Stephen Miller, said last week Bukele could become one of the strongest partners in the Central American region.
The President Bukele has graciously offered tremendous degrees of cooperation with the United States on all things migration. And we're hoping that will provide a framework for migration cooperation all throughout the region. And I think it's very clear that President Bukele is going to be a very great and strong partner for this administration and for the United States.
Trump has long admired El Salvador's prisons. The Trump administration's working with El Salvador on what is known as a safe third country agreement that would allow the U.S. to block migrants from requesting asylum in the U.S. and deport them to El Salvador, which would be designated a safe third country where they could seek asylum. Rubio began his trip in Panama, though, as Trump reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal, claiming it's being operated by China.
China's running the Panama Canal. that was not given to China, that was given to Panama foolishly, but they violated the agreement, and we're going to take it back or something very powerful is going to happen. I don't think troops will be necessary in Panama. What Panama has done is terrible for national security for this part of the world. And, you know, 70% of the signage on the Panama Canal was written in Chinese. That's not right. So it wasn't meant for China.
Speaking to reporters, Panama's president, Jose Raul Mulino, said he may expand an existing agreement with the U.S. to begin direct deportations of non-Panamanian migrants who make the dangerous journey through the Darien Gap jungle along Panama's southern border with Colombia.
On the aspect of immigration, we agreed to explore the possibility of expanding the Memorandum of Understanding that we signed on July 1st, along with the United States Department of Homeland Security, to better articulate the issue of repatriation from the Darien. Anything that is going to be done, I've offered the area of the Nicanor Track and Metiti Darien, so that it is from where the process of repatriation of people from different parts, such as Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, among other nationalities, is supplied.
All of this comes as one country is not on Rubio's itinerary, Cuba, which he was asked about on Fox News, as the State Department website now outlines a plan for, quote, restoring a tough U.S.-Cuba policy.
I have no intention of going to Havana with this regime in place other than to discuss when they're going to leave.
But Trump has announced plans to hold some 30,000 immigrants and asylum seekers in a mass detention camp at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba on the U.S. naval base there. For more, we're joined by two guests. Roman Gressier is a French-American journalist based in Guatemala City, where he's the editor of El Faro English and host of the podcast Central America in Minutes. And in Panama City, we're joined by Miriam Pensack, postdoctoral fellow in the history department at Princeton University, historian of modern Latin America. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Miriam, let's begin with you. You're in Panama City. Rubio was just there. He's saying he's taking Panama Canal back essentially from China. Can you talk about the threats and what the Panamanian president agreed to?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yes, so Rubio was here. He arrived Saturday night. He had a two-hour meeting, 1 hour privately with Mulino, and then another hour with his ministers. Afterwards, Mulino gave a press conference in which he essentially said, don't worry, we won't be invaded, which the fact that that was one of the first things he had to say is, of course, a bit troubling, to say the least. What Panama has agreed to effectively is to further collaborate on immigration, or rather deportation and repatriation, for migrants moving through the Darien Gap. There has already been a pretty extensive degree of collaboration between the United States government and the Panamanian equivalent of the Border Patrol, which is called SENAFRONT. There's an ICE office in the U.S. Embassy here in Panama City. So that collaboration has been underway for a long time. Something that Rubio did mention and Mulino agreed to is this use of this airstrip in the Darien, which has a certain degree of, I suppose, geographic utility insofar as Panama is this infrastructural hub for the Americas in general. On Monday, Rubio oversaw a deportation flight leaving from the former U.S. base at Albrook in Panama City to repatriate, or deport rather, upwards of 40 Colombians who came from the United States. So that's what we've seen so far. There's still a lot of pressure in terms of undoing the relationship with China that Panama has forged since it took up formal diplomatic relations with Beijing in 2017.
And Miriam, could you talk to us more about the current president of Panama, Mulino? Because there were mass protests, not only to Rubio's visit, but against Mulino's administration as well. How is he seen in among the Panamanian people in terms of his connection or relations to the U.S.?
Sure. So Panama in general, it should be stated, and Rubio mentioned this, Panama is you know, extremely friendly to the United States and to U.S. interests. It's very pro-business. There's really no meaningful articulation of the left in terms of electoral politics here. Something that has happened with Mulino's government, you know, he's amidst a reform of the Social Security and pension system here, which will be unpopular. So these threats from the United States have, I think, to a certain degree, united the country behind him, which he can probably use to push through legislation and pension reforms and things of that nature. Now, that being said, sovereignty has long been, understandably, because of the former Panama Canal Zone here that was operated exclusively by the United States for the majority of the 20th century, Panama has long been concerned with the question of sovereignty. So kowtowing to the United States on these issues is not popular, shall we say. Some of the protests that you saw, the burning of American flags, posters of Rubio with swastikas over his face, things like that. Most of that is carried out by a syndicalist group, a sort of union conglomerate, if you will, called Suntrax. They shut down the city, many streets on Friday. They protested in front of the U.S. Embassy. And there's just this notion that this is a reversion to the sort of mid-20th century imperial encroachment that Panama so intentionally confronted over the course of the canal transition in the last two decades of the 20th century.
And could you, this whole issue of Chinese alleged control or of the canal, the reality is Panama became the first country in Latin America to sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative of infrastructure projects of China, but there are now 22 countries in Latin America who are part of the Belt and Road Initiative. The importance of Mulino saying that they're going to review and possibly withdraw from the Belt and Road Initiative, and how extensive is Chinese investment in Panama, given the fact that the United States has largely ignored major investments in much of the region?
Sure. So, yes, the question of China. In 2017, under the government of Juan Carlos Varela, Panama did what a lot of the region has done in recent years, which is to cut ties with Taiwan and to formalize relations with Beijing. At which point there was certainly an uptick and entrance into this Belt and Roads initiative that you mentioned. So an uptick in Chinese investment, movement towards greater trade with China. Something that bears mentioning is that following the election of Donald Trump, the U.S. ambassador departed not long after, and in fact, the Trump administration and the State Department appointed no ambassador to Panama for effectively the entirety of the first Trump administration. So this really left, as Mulino said in his speech, his press conference following his meeting with Rubio, this left a lot of empty chairs into which China slid. So this Belt and Roads Initiative, Mulino said that he will not renew the agreement. That was one of the concessions that he offered Rubio in the United States. He also sort of got ahead of things. This happened in early January. So maybe after the first or second time that Trump mentioned that he was going to, quote, retake the Panama Canal, he began auditing Mulino began auditing the Hong Kong-based company that won concession bids to operate these two ports on the Atlantic and Pacific side of the canal. So that audit was, I think, a sort of preemptive attempt to hopefully find, you know, hopefully for the Panamanian government, it would be a fortuitous out to their current predicament, to hopefully find some degree of wrongdoing in the bookkeeping, something to that effect, so that there would be a reason to annul the contracts and potentially open up bids to U.S. companies to take control of those ports.
Miriam Pensa, very quickly, what would it take for the U.S. to, quote, take back what Trump keeps threatening, take back the Panama Canal?
On a logistical level, it's impossible, because the entity that runs the Panama Canal, an autonomous, effectively a state within the state of Panama, the Panama Canal Authority, operates the lock system and the pilot system, which moves, you know, it sort of leads these large container ships through the canal. It's run by roughly 8,800 Panamanian employees. So the notion that the United States could take over that, you know, the transition to have Panama take over that operation required 23 years of collaboration between the two governments. So the notion that that could be done overnight with something like, say, an executive order or something to that effect on a logistical level is quite impossible.
We want to bring Roman Gressier into this conversation. He's in Guatemala City, where Secretary of State Rubio will be. Roman, first, we want to talk about what happened in Salvador. President Trump made his first call to a foreign leader, Saudi Arabia. His second was to Bukele in El Salvador. And now Bukele, as Rubio is just leaving there, has promised to imprison American prisoners for a fee at the much admired by Trump but horrified by human rights groups prison system in El Salvador, and also to take deportees from any country. The significance of this.
Hi, it's great. It's great to be back with you. Look, I think in terms of the legal U.S. Courts question and international law, I'm not sure how that latter promise will play out, but what we can observe is that Bukele was close to Trump in his first term, and this is a way of cementing that closeness into a migration-driven alliance in his second term. From the rhetorical, where we saw a couple months ago, last June, to be exact, we saw Trump Jr., we saw Tucker Carlson and other figures in the MAGA sphere at Bukele's unconstitutional inauguration of his second term. And that was already on the rhetorical end. And then there's the anti-woke discourse that they share and a certain affinity rhetorically again. And then now they're moving more formally into the realm of migration cooperation. Now, in 2019, the Trump administration had negotiated with El Salvador a safe third country agreement. And this would clearly, at least on the rhetorical end, go much further than that. We'll have to see what actually, parsing the language a little bit, Rubio said that Bukele had offered to receive U.S. citizens convicted of crimes and incarcerated in the United States. But the other things were Bukele agreed to. So I think that the Tren de Aragua and MS-13 deportees are perhaps more immediately likely or possible than the latter.
And Roman, I wanted to ask you, of the five countries that Rubio is visiting, all of them have relatively conservative governments, and with the exception of Guatemala. What do you expect? What's your sense of what Rubio hopes to get out of Guatemala and how that government may respond?
I think migration is the item of the day. Rubio will be arriving this afternoon, and he'll be here tomorrow. Excuse me. And tomorrow afternoon, he'll be giving a press conference summing up his Guatemala trip. The Arevalo administration is since the transition has been meeting with Trump officials and the Heritage Foundation to promote the idea that they can get along, and that as they told the U.S. press on background, I don't think they wanted to put a name to it, perhaps for optics, but they told the U.S. press on background that the Arevalo administration would be open to discussing the possibility of receiving regional return deportees. So I think on that plane, that will be a topic of discussion, and it's certainly of interest to Marco Rubio. But there's a broader political issue where the Arevalo administration has been trying to send the signal that they can get along, in part because the public prosecutor's office, which has been working to, which first worked to prevent Arevalo from taking office in January 2024, has now been working to, put him on trial, remove him from office, et cetera. And just last week, the Supreme Court decided to move forward with a probe of Arevalo that could possibly lead to the revocation of his immunity from prosecution. Anyhow, it's a very drawn out process, but the Supreme Court kicked the ball forward on that last week. So I think that domestic context is very important, given that the Attorney General and her office have been eagerly courting Trump's support and trying to promote the idea that they defend a conservative agenda.
And I'm wondering if you could, if we could look back at the broader picture of this indication of the Trump administration focusing on Latin America in its first days in office for the ostensibly over the migration crisis and fentanyl, but also over China's growing influence. Isn't the reality already that China has become the main economic partner of South America? It's the largest trading partner with South America and the second largest with Latin America as a whole. So really, the United States has been for now decades losing control of the markets of Latin America for its goods. Your sense of whether this has any impact on how the Trump administration is approaching the region?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It does have Marco Rubio's fingerprint on it. And even in his recent Senate hearings during the Biden administration, he would frequently talk about Chinese influence in the region. Honduras broke relations with Taiwan 2 years ago, and Guatemala and Belize, which is part of the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, are the only two remaining countries. Now, Guatemala has kind of a balancing act where they maintain historic relations with Taiwan while also having informal commercial ties to China. And I think that could possibly be a topic of discussion for the visit too, especially given that Marco Rubio is very interested in China policy as it pertains to Central America and the broader region, as you pointed out.
And very quickly, Roman, Latin America, and particularly Central America, a place for the Trump administration to actually make money. You have President Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Commerce, Howard Lutnick, also has ties to El Salvador. He's the billionaire CEO of the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald, which is a major backer of Tether, a cryptocurrency firm that recently announced it's relocating to El Salvador. Bloomberg recently ran an article headlined, Commerce nominee Lutnick is backer of Outlaw's favorite cryptocurrency. The article states that Tether is used by, quote, drug traffickers, terrorists, and scammers to move money around the world. Your response, Roman?
I don't want to get in over my head on that. I wasn't aware of Lutnick's relationship, but it is true that Tether does have a presence in El Salvador and that an array of cryptocurrency companies, major players on the global scale, have had some type of presence in El Salvador since 2021, when the Bitcoin law was passed. Though I would note that the Bitcoin law was basically gutted in recent days. And for example, any language referencing Bitcoin as current or moneda or currency was struck from the law, among others, as part of an IMF financing deal. So I'm not sure what exactly the political implications would be of Lutnick's appointment, but we'll have to watch and see.
I also wanted to ask Miriam Pensack about Guantanamo. The Pentagon saying some 300 additional soldiers have arrived at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have begun constructing a tent city to detain up to 30,000 immigrants and asylum seekers. On Monday, the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, condemned the Trump administration's attack on asylum seekers. This is what he said.
For Cuba, the violent and indiscriminate deportation of immigrants by the United States, arbitrary detentions, and other human rights violations are unacceptable. These measures are also used as a political pressure and blackmail weapon against the peoples of our America. The establishment of a detention center at the American Naval Base in Guantanamo, where it is intended to imprison tens of thousands of people, constitutes a barbaric act.
So that's the president of Cuba. Miriam Pensack, your forthcoming book is on Guantanamo. Can you give us the history of how the U.S. has used it?
Sure. So something that I should mention first and foremost is that before Guantanamo became what it was known for in the early 21st century, this sort of forever prison in the war on terror, the way that its ambiguous sovereignty as a U.S. base coercively held on Cuban soil functioned was to hold tens of thousands of circum-Caribbean asylum seekers, first from Haiti, roughly 40,000 from Haiti, then 35,000 Cubans who fled the island during the what was called the special period, so the collapse of the Soviet Union, which prompted the total collapse of Cuba's economy in the mid-90s. So this is actually a sort of back to basics, unfortunately, for Guantanamo. Initiatives, first the Haitian internment and then the Baucedo crisis of Cuban rafters a few years later. What happened with the Haitians, they were by and large repatriated to extremely dangerous conditions in Haiti, where a coup had taken place against Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Cubans eventually made it to the United States, but not after, you know, after effectively being held in what were concentration camp, detention camp-like conditions in Guantanamo. And they were allowed into the United States because, in part because of the establishment of what became known as wet foot, dry foot.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you about the Dominican Republic, where Rubio will also be visiting. The Dominican Republic has for years been involved in its own migration crackdown against Haitians within the country, massive attempts to deport Haitians from the DR. What do you sense might come out of Rubio's visit there?
I think there will definitely be a willingness to collaborate on immigration and deportation. You know, the Dominican Republic has been building a wall between itself and Haiti, which it shares, the island of Hispaniola with. There have been these mass attempts to deport Haitians. There have also been efforts to strip Dominican citizens of their citizenship if they have what has been in many cases very flimsy proof of Haitian origin or provenance, you know, so it's a very anti-black because Haiti was the first black republic and Haitians are, there are plenty of black Dominicans, I should say, but there is a huge degree of anti-blackness involved in that. And the Dominican Republic has in fact left some of its citizens who it deemed Haitian stateless because Haiti did not recognize them as Haitian citizens.
Miriam Pensack, we want to thank you so much for being with us, historian of modern Latin America, postdoc fellow at Princeton University, writing a book on Guantanamo. Roman Gressier is French-American journalist based in Guatemala City, where he's the editor of Alfaro English, host of the podcast Central America in Minutes. And Miriam was speaking to us from Panama City, where Secretary of State Rubio just was. Coming up, President Trump's threatening to deport pro-Palestinian student protesters. In a recent executive order, he urges schools to, quote, monitor and report activities by alien students. We'll speak with a student who is threatened with deportation at Cornell University and with an Israeli reporter, a conscientious objector, who just wrote a piece for Haaretz on deporting those who support justice in Palestine. Stay with us. الخربة الحزينة سلم لي عريحة وسلم عالديرة يطير الطير الأرض الكريمة يخدوش اللي فينا سلم لي عريحة وسلم عالديرة يطير الطير بين الشط والرمال بداية حياتي أحلق يا وطن فرحة ومآسي أحلق وطن الغالي فلسطين حبيبة featuring MC Abdul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump hosts Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today, we turn to an executive order Trump signed last week to combat, he said, anti-Semitism that has sent a chill across campuses. In a White House fact sheet, accompanying the executive order. Trump threatened to deport non-citizen college students and other international visitors who take part in pro-Palestinian protests. Trump said, quote, to all the resident aliens who joined in the pro-jihadist protests, we put you on notice. Come 2025, we'll find you and we will deport you. I will also quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radicalism like never before, Trump said. The executive order promises to, quote, marshal all federal resources to combat what are called the explosion of anti-Semitism on our campuses and streets, unquote, since October 7, 2023. It calls on the Secretary of Education to provide an inventory and analysis of all court cases involving anti-Semitism at colleges, university, and K-12 schools within 60 days. The order requires colleges and universities to, quote, monitor for and report activities by alien students and staff that could be considered anti-Semitic or supportive of terrorism, potentially leading to their deportation. In response to Israel's 16th month military assault on Gaza, campuses across the U.S. erupted an unprecedented wave of pro-Palestinian protests in solidarity with Gaza. University administrations responded with a harsh crackdown. At least 3,000 people were arrested or detained during the height of the protests last year. Rights groups and legal scholars say the new executive order violates constitutional free speech rights and would likely draw legal challenges if implemented. For more on this executive order, we're going to two guests. In Ithaca, New York, Mamadou Tal is with us, a PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University. Last year, Cornell suspended him for taking part in a campus protest calling on Cornell to divest from Israel. He faced deportation until Cornell allowed him to re-enroll after massive protests, thereby extending his visa. And Eitan Nechin is with us, the New York correspondent for Haaretz, where his recent piece is headlined, "We Will Find You and We Will Deport You, Why Trump's Executive Order on Anti-Semitism is So Dangerous." Eitan Nechin joins us from Washington, D.C., where he's covering protests of Netanyahu today at the White House. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Eitan, let's begin with you. Why do you say Trump's anti-Semitism executive order worries progressive Jewish groups, delights others, and you write that it is a major problem that he's threatening to deport students? As an Israeli, you write this.
Good morning, Amy. Good to be on. Well, this is dangerous not only for crushing dissent, but it's a deflection from what's going on in Israel and Palestine, right? So when we focus on students who are pro-Palestinian, who some, you know, said egregious things, it's still free speech. When you create a atmosphere that any dissent could be punished by deportation, that sends a chilling effect not only on foreign students, but on anyone who dares to criticize Israel, the administration. And this creates atmosphere that we have seen from authoritarian regimes, right? So this is basically a textbook authoritarian playbook meant to just stifle any criticism of what's going on in Israel. This campaign promise last year, and we've seen it's already been implementing even before. Right-wing Jewish group Beitar has already used AI to scrape social media to make lists of names of what they called Hamas supporters. This group just now recently attacked writer Peter Beinart for his new book about criticism of Israel. Peter Beinart is not a Hamas supporter, obviously. So this just shows the line of, you know, between free speech and a crackdown.
And who runs this Betar movement, and how did it arise?
Betar U.S. is part of Betar movement, which is founded in the 1920s by Jabotinsky, a very right-wing Zionist. And they have branches all over the world. So this is their U.S. branch. Also, there have been messaging on Jewish and Israeli text groups urging people to complain about anybody who's supporting Hamas. Again, the language in this order is so murky. What does it mean to be supportive of Hamas? Is it to wave a Palestinian flag? Because a lot of Israelis in protests have done so. Is it saying that, you know, if somebody was at the right age, they would join a resistance movement? Because that's what Ehud Barak said, former prime minister, during his campaign in 1999. This is not justifying what Hamas did on October 7th, not at all. But this is the line between free speech and crackdown authoritarianism. This is the aim and this is the goal.
I wanted to ask you about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther, which claims that a pro-Palestinian movement, that the pro-Palestinian movement here is a part of a global Hamas support network. And they issued a 33-page document that's suggesting revoking tax-exempt status for universities who host a pro-Palestinian protest. What's your reaction? Is that even feasible?
Right. This is, you know, Project Esther is part of Project 2025, which aims, again, to, through very vague language, crack down anybody who criticizes Israel as, you know, a terrorist supporter. And this is part of the administration's and the GOP's plan to crack down on nonprofits. And we've seen that last session where they tried to pass a bill. You know, basically gutting funding for nonprofit who support terrorism or whatever that language is, a bill that will be taken on this session. So this is part of a big crackdown on nonprofits and any human rights, speech rights, migrant rights. We've seen this across the board. Project Esther is one of the projects of 2025. You know, which centers around migration, centers around attacking of minorities on dissent on the left. And we've seen this, after 9/11, obviously, when, you know, protesters against the Iraq war were monitors supporting Al-Qaeda, right? The FBI had filed on people and nonprofits to try and stifle any dissent. This is part of the same playbook. What's more dangerous at this moment is Project 2025 and Elon Musk. I don't think there has been in the recent history such a tie between the government and a billionaire oligarch that basically has a run on the government and can do what his will. And where we've been seeing that since day one.
We're talking to Eitan Netchen, who is the New York correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's in Washington, D.C. today to cover the protests against Netanyahu. It's his first visit to the United States, to the White House, since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him for crimes against humanity. There were two other presidents who came to the inauguration, Boo of Ecuador and the right-wing president of Argentina, but this is the first official White House visit that Trump is having Netanyahu. They are close personal friends. We're also joined by Mamadou Tal, PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University, almost deported last year after being temporarily suspended for his pro-Palestine activism. Mohammed, if you can talk about what happened to you, we would report your story in headlines. There was tremendous outcry and pressure on Cornell to remove the suspension so you wouldn't be deported. Explain what happened.
Yes. So we partook in a protest at Statler Hotel on Cornell's campus. And in that career fair, which was taking place at Statler Hotel, there was Boeing and L3 Harris, who are targets of our divestment campaign, because we know that L3 Harris and Boeing are directly involved in shipments and armaments of Israelis' genocide against the Palestinian people. We eventually brought the careers fair to a standstill. And about a few days later, I was told that I was suspended. And someone on the F1 visa, being suspended means that you lose your student status, which triggers the loss of your visa, effectively being deported, being asked to leave the country. I was told in that meeting that I will have about 48 hours to leave the country. With, as you said, public pressure, support, Cornell University back down, and I'm allowed to finish my degree. However, I am still banned from campus. I'm allowed in one building on campus to work. I had to fight to be able to get library access. And I think there's somewhat of a great irony that students who are protesting apartheid are now subject to forms of exclusion, bordering, and apartheid, with our movements restricted, and we're only allowed to go to designated places on campus.
And how has the, your work and as a graduate student continued to be affected since the university rescinded your suspension?
It continues to be impacted because, first and foremost, I'm excluded from campus life. I was teaching a class to undergrads, which was effectively banned from teaching. My class was taken away from me, which everyone knows is a huge part of progression with your degree. My movements remain restricted. I had to fight, as I said, to be able to use the library, to have work from the library, right? To be able to go onto campus and to use certain access of certain parts of campus. Right now, as I said, I'm still only allowed in one building on campus. To demonstrate the egregious nature of this, I had to even fight with the university to say, if I use Cornell Health, go to see a doctor. Initially, I was told I have to inform them every single time I have a doctor's appointment to be allowed onto campus.
Mamadou, can you respond to Trump's executive order as he talks about alien students being deported? Your colleagues at Cornell and other places that you're hearing from, what kind of effect that this has had? And also, I mean, you were born in Gambia. You are a British citizen. Why you support the Palestinians and were involved in those protests?
Thank you for both those questions. For the first one, of course, the executive orders, the language in which, the framing and the language of the executive orders clearly are targeting pro-Palestinian protesters, international students. And I think they're intended to have a chilling effect on Palestinian protests, pro-Palestinian protesters, in order for them to stop protesting at the threat of deportation. The message that is being sent out is, if you are an international student who comes here legally, then you should not be involved in exercising your First Amendment right, or you will be subject to deportation. And that is the intended effect. I don't think it's going to work. I think if anything, when fascism is at the door, what we do is come together and unite even stronger. However, as for your second question, I think fundamentally, yes, I'm Gambian. Yes, I'm British. But fundamentally, I'm a human being. And I think what Palestine does, when we say Palestine is a litmus test, we're saying that it is not that we privilege the Palestinian cause among over every other cause, but rather Palestine holds a mirror up into the world and says, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do you want to live in a world in which every single international multilateral institution is rubbish? Do you want to live in a world where the ICC and the ICJ are rendered defunct and the UN rendered defunct, and there's no such thing as an international cooperation of a world, and people are able to do, leaders are able to act in any way they see fit and kill women and children and men and boys and enact genocide? So I think fundamentally why I get involved is because I'm a human being. And finally, I will end with, the university was presented with a crossroad. That crossroad, will they protect those students? They failed initially by suspending so many people. Again, now with Trump's presidency, the university is presented with another crossroad. And I'm calling on the university to not just be a bystander, but take an active position, an active role to defend their students and say, we're not going to allow Trump and right-wing fascists and outside agencies to come onto campuses and collect foreign students.
Mamadou, we have to leave it there. Mamadou Tal was threatened with deportation. That was during the Biden administration, and now it faces this executive order by Trump. And I want to thank Eitan Netchen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Arjun Das. You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm joined today by Dave Mawinney. Dave, how's it going?
It's going great, Arjun.
Yeah, so Pittsburgh is known for many things. Winning at football, losing at baseball, pierogies, steel mills, and soon enough it might be known for something new, tech startups. That's in no small part, thanks to our friend here, the efforts of today's guest, Dave Mawinney. Dave is the executive director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU's Tepper School of Business, which is one of the premier hubs for startup activity in the Pittsburgh metro area. So Dave, you're a Pittsburgh kid. Tell us how you got to startups and how'd you find out that it was a viable career path?
Oh, wow. So I grew up a grandson of a steelworker, the son of a Presbyterian minister. So I was at the low end of the middle class, and when I graduated high school, the steel industry tanked, and everybody left town. And I was seeing some people be successful in other cities. I would read Forbes magazine, I would read Fortune magazine, and they would talk about the entrepreneurs. And I would think to myself, why not? Why couldn't I pursue that? And so it was something that stuck in my head through my undergraduate education. And I was actually getting a PhD in physics at Georgia Tech. And I realized that the tech side wasn't the side that I would be the best at. It was at the selling side. And so I decided then to be an entrepreneur. And that led me back to Carnegie Mellon, where at the time it was pre-internet. You couldn't learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. You had to go to business school to be an internet. And Carnegie Mellon had one of the best business schools in the world, and it had one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the world. In 1971, the president of the university, Dick Seyert, hired Jack Thorne to start the first entrepreneurship program at any university. So that reputation led me here, and from that point, I launched my entrepreneurial career.
Interesting. So what was the first company that you founded?
Yeah. So a guy named Don Jones was a successful entrepreneur in the Pittsburgh area, and he gave $1 million in 1989, which was a lot of money in 1989, to found the Don Jones Center for Entrepreneurship at the Tepper School of Business. I was very fortunate to be a student at the Tepper School at that time. It was called GSIA, the Graduate School of Industrial Administration. And I said, that's the guy I'm going to start a business with. So I stalked that poor guy. And so there was an event downtown. It was called Entrepreneurs Day. And there was, you know, it was like a trade show. But they had a VIP lunch. And you had to pay to get into the VIP lunch. So I snuck in the room and found the table with Don's name on it. I took two chairs and I put them up, like, to save the chairs. I snuck back out of the room, and it was like festival seating. So I ran and I snuck and got first in line at the door. And so they opened the doors and I ran to that table. And I sat there with my arm on the table with the chair, so no one took that chair next to me. And Don came in and I jumped up, Don, sit here. And so he came over and sat down right next to me. And at the time, he said he was going to retire from startups. And so I worked through the lunch to get my courage up. I was nervous as hell. And finally, I looked at him. I said, Don, entrepreneurs never retire. You're going to start another company, and you're going to start it with me. And he started to laugh at me. But it wasn't like he was laughing at me like I'm an idiot. It was like, I can't believe you had the cojones to ask that question. And that started the relationship. And literally, we started the company while I was still a graduate student here at Carnegie Mellon. And it was called IndustryNet. And it grew in time to be the largest business-to-business site on the early internet in 1995. There's a rest of the story that I can tell you a little bit later in the Q&A, but that's how I got my start.
Awesome. Yeah. So